We've got some guest speakers. We got a special
Chip,
guy.
Chip Horton's in here right now.
And Chip Horton's going to be one of our speakers.
Chip, come back, buddy. Tell us.
I'll be there.
Chip is going to be doing one of our devotionals at that thing next Tuesday at 7 o'clock at North Jefferson. So this is an area-wide thing. If you live in Northeast Texas, you're within listening distance. Wait a minute. This is the World Wide Web. You could be across the world.
Across the world.
But anyway, if you live right up here in Northeast Texas, if you're within an hour away, you probably want to come over here and get in on some of that. We've got Philip Hinesley, who's going to do one of the devotionals. I'm going to be doing one of them. JJ, you're not going to be doing anything.
I will
anything.
Not be doing anything.
You're not actually going to be there.
I won't even be there.
You are like half, most of all the gospel preachers in our area are going to be gone starting Monday. Mm-hmm. They're going wherever they're going to go for Thanksgiving.
Yep, I have a day planned out for my bride. It's her birthday on the 21st. So,
is it really? How old is she going to be?
Oh, I'm not going to play that game.
20 what?
22, 23.
23
like
again. Okay, good deal. We like that. That's good. It's good stuff. Well, so besides the Bible Bowl at North Jefferson and the
let's make a little plug for Watermelon Mills Coffee Shop. Chris and I stopped at Watermelon Mills this morning, and I was asking them like for a Frappuccino, and they had hazelnut. And I said, "Could you mix some chocolate with that and see if we could get it to taste like Nutella?" And the lady acted like she'd never even thought of that idea before. It doesn't taste exactly like Nutella, but it's not bad. What did you get again?
Regular coffee.
How was it?
It's good.
It's very regular.
Yeah.
Nice. But
tasted like coffee.
The nice folks over at Watermelon Mills let us pay full price for their coffee.
We have some newlyweds in our area. We want to shout out and give a little congratulation to Hunter and Kaylee. And in their marriage this past Saturday. And I want to commend all of their family and friends that helped. Now, this is you know, these I have great ideas, but they're afterthoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And after we left and got home, I was laying in bed about 10 o'clock when, you know, that Saturday night. And I got to thinking, I thought, I wonder if that family is still up there taking down all the. I mean, they had that place. The Northridge Church building is no small building.
It's not a small building.
And they had that thing decked out from the auditorium all the way back. And I don't know what even, you know, they probably used some of the classrooms, you know, for dressing rooms. So you have to clean all that up. You have to clean the auditorium up. And you got to clean all the fellowship hall up and all the four, everything that was in there. I mean, they had tons of stuff. It was amazing. It was a beautiful wedding. Don't get me wrong. It was wonderful. But as I thought about it, I thought, oh, man, you know, it's going to be 1 o'clock in the morning until they get out of there. And then I asked Candy at Bible Bowl the other night. I said, what time did y'all wind up getting out of there? She says, well, we were thankfully out of there by 10 o'clock. Had everything taken down. Everything was back in order for Sunday services. And I thought, you know what? That is really cool. And it takes a team of people to get that kind of thing done. And I'm going to tell you what, there's a lot of people that were invested in that couple, and they've been invested. I think it's just wonderful to have a young Christian couple that are as fine as Hunter and Kaylee are, to, you know, to have such support from both sides of the family and all these church families that have come together to, you know, to celebrate God's plan for the family. Mm-hmm. It's His design. And so,
I think the only thing that would make them better is, you know, if they started attending North Jefferson. So,
well, you want to hit them up about it?
No, don't want to do no sheep stealing.
Well, they'd be some good sheep to steal.
They would be
fine young.
Got a lot of good folks around here.
All right. Well, so let's talk about Micah for just a minute. I mean, what are we really looking at when we're talking about Micah? He's one of the minor prophets. Micah. His name means "who is like unto Jehovah." That's what his name means. Almost the very question with which the prophet concluded his book in chapter 7, verse 18. He is identified as the Moreshite, that is, a dweller in Moresheth, and it's a rural village about 22 miles southwest of Jerusalem. It used to be, called Moresheth Gath, And that was because it was formerly dependent on the Philistine city of Gath. I didn't know that, but I thought that was interesting. And so he, Micah, may have identified himself by his hometown to distinguish himself from the fearless prophet Micaiah, the son of Imlah, who withstood Ahab and his 400 hired prophets some two centuries earlier, according to 1 Kings chapter 22, verse 8. So we get a little background on who this guy is. In Micah, you know, he was a man of the country, kind of a country boy prophet. And this in no way diminished his power as a spokesman for God. He was a very powerful speaker for God. We're told nothing about his parents. And so, you know, we're led to believe that he was a man who arose out of humble origins, especially as he talks about the birth of Christ, who would emerge out of humble origins. So we don't really told anything about his family, but I just think it's kind of interesting to look at the guy himself and find out a little bit about why God might have chosen this man to do this particular work with this particular message.
Right. It's believed he was a contemporary with Isaiah and Hosea. So it's Isaiah, Hosea, great name for some for twins.
Now, now we're supposed to be talking about chapters 4 and 5 today.
Right.
But chapter 4, really, it begins with a conjuncting word. Did you notice that?
I didn't.
Yeah, which means that you've got to consider the, you know, the previous context. This paragraph actually interrupts the message of judgment upon Jerusalem with one of great hope and promise. I mean, you know the theme of so many of these prophets in the Old Testament, destruction, you know, repentance. Get right with God or I'm going to destroy you. We've read through some of those things in the Old Testament. Well, that's what's going on here, too. I mean, he preached the same thing. But this is kind of an interval where he introduced great hope and promise. And as discussed in the earlier chapters, if you look at Isaiah chapter 2, verses 2 through 4, the verses 1 through 3 are almost identical to that. This is the most beautiful, detailed, and wonderful description of the establishment of the Lord's church to be found in the Holy Bible. And it's not just found once, it's found twice in the Old Testament. And I don't, you know, it's a little wonder that the devil and skeptics do their best to discredit these particular verses. And so, you know, we see the words "in the last days" literally means the end of days. This kind of marks a time frame for us. And it can mean the last days of the Jewish dispensation, or it may refer to the last dispensation, which is the Christian age as a whole. But in either case, the actual time is the same, since the end of the former marked the beginning of the latter. And so this is an unmistakable reference to the time of Messiah. And so let's just get into the reading of the text and try to decipher some of this stuff here that we've got. What do we got? We've got the capture of the city of David. Well, let's see. We've got the coming of the son of David here in verses 1 through 8. And so let's dig in. What do we have?
All right. It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains, and it shall be lifted up above the hills, and people shall flow to it. And many nations shall come and say, "Come, let us go up on the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between many peoples, and shall decide for strong nations far away, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. But they shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken. For all the peoples walk, each in the name of its God, but we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever."
Okay, so we start off with a promise of the temple of God being built. Mm-hmm. It's going to be the Universal Worship Center, so to speak. But we're not talking about a physical building, are we?
No.
The mountain of the Lord's house. The house of the Lord is the family of God. It's the people of God. And in the New Testament, the church is the household of God. The church is the people. And so whether we're talking about the Lord's house, the church, the temple, we're all talking about the same group of people in Christ. And we know that it is going to be established beginning at Jerusalem. It will be established as the chief of the mountains. I think the word mountain here, the mountain of the Lord's house, is a metaphor. Now, I know that there's a sense in which Jerusalem is considered up on a hill.
Yeah.
But this mountain, mountains are figurative for what in the Bible? What do they represent?
Leaders, right?
Well, you know, leadership or power.
Power,
you know,
yeah.
Strength, all right? And so it's going to be raised above the hills, so it's going to tower above everything. And the peoples will stream to it. And many nations will come and will say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord and to the house of the God of Jacob. And why are they going to go there? Why do they want to go there? That he may what?
Teach us his ways.
Teach us his ways. Then that we may walk in his paths. And from Zion, there's the place, Jerusalem, will go forth the law.
I think there's a point to be made there. When we see teach us his ways that we may walk in his path, there's some people that think that they can walk however they want and that God will accept it as long as they say they're doing it in his name. But truth be told, we have the Bible, the God-inspired word, 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 16 and 17.
Yeah.
And with that God-inspired word, we have what God's expectations are. So what we see here is let him teach us his ways that we may walk in his paths.
Yeah, and that is the essence of Christianity, is that we have a teacher, Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And he teaches how to think and how to behave. Now, it says here that the word will go forth from Zion. Here in Luke chapter 24, thus it was written, verse 45, that Christ should suffer and rise again from the dead on the third day, and that repentance and forgiveness of sins should be preached or proclaimed in his name among all nations, beginning from Jerusalem. And I think that is exactly the same thing that we're talking about here. And you go to Acts chapter 2, and that's a fulfillment of everything that they had said. They'd been told to tarry in Jerusalem till they be endued with power from on high. When the Holy Spirit descended, they would be able to communicate to all the languages of peoples that were gathered there that day and for during that period of the feast. And so these things were predicted back then here in Micah.
Do you think that there could be any correlation to the highest of mountains being the church and the hills being the law of the patriarchs and the law of Moses, or am I looking at that the wrong way?
Well, it's metaphorical, and so I'm not the smartest dude out there about what all the representations are, but I'm willing to go along with you on that because there were other influences out there. You know, I mean, it's almost like Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration, and you got Moses and Elijah, and who towered above those two dudes?
Jesus did.
Jesus did. I mean, it was the Lord was in the spotlight there in that moment. So I don't have any, why I may look at the other mountains and say in this metaphor and say, well, maybe it's talking about the law and the prophets. You know, I don't think we're really off base on that. I think we see the church as the preeminent thing there. And so, I think it's interesting because you talk about the word going forth from Zion, the word of the Lord. And in verse number 3, it says, and he will judge between many peoples and render decisions for the mighty distant nations. Then they will hammer their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Now, what is significant about these mighty distant nations taking their hammers and converting their swords to plowshares?
It means they weren't going to fight anymore. That you don't need the swords, so you're going to use them for something else.
That's right. Yeah, and their spears into pruning hooks.
Yeah.
You know, there's going to be a prosperity. You know, there's a prosperous. You know, the mm-hmm. The even the land itself is going to be used for growing things. It's not, you know, it's not going to be battles and stuff. Nation will not lift up sword against nation. Now, let me ask you a question. We see wars happening today. We have wars and rumors of wars, don't we? Mm-hmm. I mean, we've got our nation, and I think it was they were talking about this on WBAP this morning. You know, diplomacy is for reasonable nations where you can sit there and talk and work out a deal. But you use a bullhorn on people like North Korea.
Yeah. Apparently North Korea has sentenced Donald Trump to death. I saw that on Facebook this morning. And what is the saddest thing about that is there are Americans that are siding with North Korea. It's like they have no idea how awful it is in North Korea, and they hate Donald Trump so much. They're going to side with a man that's killed members of his family, that's killed millions of people, and they're going to side with him over our president. That's ridiculous.
This is another kind of the sign of our times. We have people that will jump on any bandwagon for any reason, in any moment. If what they're saying, I mean, it reminds me a lot about the people that decided to kill Jesus. I mean, the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Pharisees, they never could get along. But they could get along for one reason. And if it had something to do with killing Jesus, they could unite on that issue.
Right.
And when people find themselves uniting that would otherwise not unite, just simply, I mean, the unitedness is only on this issue. It's not on anything else. You know, I guarantee you it's not. But they're not thinking about the fact that they're warming their hands by the wrong fire on this thing.
Oh, no, you know, and I mean, I'm conservative, and I didn't like a lot of what Barack Obama did, but if North Korea had said they wanted to kill him, I'd have been like, not our president. I mean,
this is an American.
This is an American, and I mean, it boggles my mind to see people getting on there. And
this is ungodly talk, though. I mean, you think about it. Now, I'm with you. I didn't agree with everything Obama did, and I was really offended at the, you know, it is display of colors, you know, for Gay Pride Week and everything like that. I mean, there were things that he did that I didn't approve of. Okay, I'm one person in the country,
right?
And I mean, there may be other people that are with me on that, but I don't wish him evil.
No,
you know, my Bible told me to pray for him,
which we did,
and we did, and so you know. But let me tell you something. You know, when we have seen people make figurines that look like Donald Trump with a noose around his neck.
Yeah.
They did that to Barack Obama.
But it was called hate when they did it, when the conservatives did it to him, but it's called freedom of expression when it comes to the left.
Yeah.
Doesn't make sense.
Well, there, you know.
Should be hate both ways.
Oh, consistency, where art thou? But anyway, I think we get the point.
And I agree. They never should have done that to Obama either.
Well, so nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they train for war. And each of them will sit under his vine and under his fig tree. Now, I've got to ask the question, because I don't know what Micah's referring to here.
I could almost think that you saw the Gentiles and the Jews fighting. And this is just off the top of my head. Like I said, I'm not an aficionado towards Micah. But it seems to me like you've got Jews and Gentiles that fight. But after Acts chapter 10, we see that there is one. There's no more law of the patriarchs. There's no more law of Moses. There is one law of Christ. So there shouldn't be any warring between God's people anymore. There's only one God's people. But, I mean, that's something that we could see, unless this is talking about heavenly.
Well, you know, here's where we have to jump out of the physical and into the spiritual. And,
all right.
And Micah is not really talking about political peace.
No.
We know that that has not been.
Yeah.
All right? But spiritual peace, because Jesus is the Prince of Peace, and he's come to bring peace. Now he came not to bring peace but a sword. I'm trying to cross that up. But I am saying that Jesus was the Prince of Peace.
Mm-hmm.
And when the fact that Jesus said, I've come not to bring peace but a sword, and yet he's the Prince of Peace, we know that his doctrine is what's going to cause the problem. But his doctrine is also what's going to be the fix.
Right.
So that's what we're talking about is spiritual peace. And because this spiritual kingdom is global, I mean, it's all over the place. It doesn't have walls. It doesn't have boundaries. It's not located on a specific. You know, Jesus said, you know, the kingdom is not like people are going to say, lo, here it is, or lo, here it is. He says, no, the kingdom of God is within you. And so we know that it's a spiritual concept. All right? And we got that cleared up. I think in my mind, when I think of this in spiritual terms, I get it. And because of that, I can rest in peace.
Mm-hmm.
I can be in peace. We're not at war. Notice, if you will, verse number 4, each of them will sit under his vine and under his fig tree, and no one to make them afraid. Why are they not going to be afraid? You know, why are they not going to have anything to fear?
The worst thing that somebody can do to a Christian is kill them. Because if we're right with God, nobody can separate that. If we choose to willfully walk away, as Hebrews 10, 26, and 27 state, then we have a problem. But if we are right with God, nothing can separate us.
You know, you say that, you know, Matthew chapter 10, 28 teaches that godly fear casts out fear of any man.
Mm-hmm.
Fear not those who are able to kill the body, but fear him who's able to kill both body and soul in hell.
Mm-hmm.
And that's God. That's God alone. You know, their conviction that he had, that he is within them is greater than he that is in the world, 1 John 4 and verse number 4. And so this generates a sense, a great sense of not just a sense, but the reality of a security that nobody else can understand. And so Micah's prediction regarding Zion's future has received two very different interpretations. Some see this as a prediction of the millennial reign of Christ, the 1,000 years of peace with Christ ruling from the throne of David in Jerusalem. You know, you've heard that doctrine before.
Mm-hmm.
Others see this verse as a picture of the New Testament Zion, the church of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, and that's where we would fall. But in any case, I think that if you look at where Christ's government prevails, peace is going to follow. Now, if there was some kind of temporal, physical application to this, then I'm not aware of it. But it seems to be that prophecy can be kind of like that, you know, dualistic.
Yeah, they understood it to mean one thing, and we can understand it to mean another. I mean,
well, this is the ultimate sense,
yep.
You know, is Christ's reign.
We look at back to Moses. Moses, toward the end of his life, said a prophet greater than I is going to come, and he knew that because of messianic prophecy. He didn't know who it was, but he knew somebody great was going to come, and we have the benefit of hindsight, so we're able to see that it was Jesus. And they understood that somebody greater was going to come. It's just when Jesus came, they were looking in the wrong places.
Hey, I was going to tell you just a little interjection here about David's throne and Jesus sitting on David's throne. I want to tell you, maybe there's somebody listening today that doesn't understand about premillennialism. Let me say something. You know, the idea, one of the basic core concepts of premillennialism is that Jesus Christ will come back one day and sit on David's literal throne in literal Jerusalem. All right, that's one of the core concepts, is that he will one day come and for 1,000 years will reign in the city of Jerusalem. He will have a global reign, and you know that's supposed to be a really good time period. Okay, well, there's only one problem with that. Now, if you look at Acts 2:29, brethren, I may confidently say that you regarding the patriarch David, that he has both died and buried, and that his tomb is with us today. And so, because he was a prophet and knew that God had sworn with an oath to him that one of his descendants would sit upon his throne. Now, he looked ahead and spoke of the resurrection of the Christ, and that he was neither abandoned to Hades nor did his flesh suffer decay. Now, think about this. If David himself prophesied that one of his descendants would sit on his throne, but he was looking ahead to the resurrection of the Christ, then that equates the resurrection of Christ with the concept that David had that Jesus would sit on his throne one day.
Mm-hmm.
So to say, to speak of the resurrection is to say that Jesus is on David's throne.
Right.
Now, you have a problem if premillennialism has a problem if they don't acknowledge that he's not already on David's throne.
Yep. And the whole theory is, and I've heard people argue it, that it was it wasn't necessarily Jesus' time to die, and that this is a waiting period until the return. And it's just like, that goes against so many prophecies, that goes against so many things that Jesus himself said. And that goes against God saying that sticks and stones and swords were enough to stop what God would have them to do. But Jesus is going to return in times right now where we have like nuclear warhead bazookas and is going to be able to overcome. And it's just, it kind of makes you scratch your head that God wasn't powerful enough to send Jesus at the proper time. There's so many things that are wrong with premillennialism.
The implications are damning.
Yeah.
And I looked at this verse here and I thought, you know, this has him sitting on his throne.
Mm-hmm.
And he's reigning right now. He is called the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords right now.
Right now.
Not in the future. And Jesus said to Pilate, "My kingdom is not of this world." Friends, I want you to understand, Jesus used that in the present tense.
Yeah.
And that goes all the way, this goes all the way back to Samuel, when Israel wanted a king. Do you remember what God said to Samuel? Don't get so discouraged. They have not rejected you.
Yeah, they rejected me.
From being what?
King. Or judge.
No.
I'm
king.
King. That's what I said.
That's right. And you're sitting here thinking, the kingdom hadn't even been established yet. But it was.
Mm-hmm.
It was always an eternal kingdom. When we talk about the eternal kingdom, it is eternal in nature. And so, you know, the kingdom concept, whether man acknowledged the government of the Lord or not, it was always there. The government of the Lord has always been. It may not have always been manifested. Man may have strayed from it. But what Jesus Christ set up is what was always in the mind of God. Think about that for just a moment. So this is not a Johnny come lately idea either, you know. And, you know, when Jesus taught his disciples to pray, "Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come." When he prayed, "Thy kingdom come," he wasn't saying, "Thy kingdom come into existence." It's "thy kingdom come into the hearts of men." I mean, the kingdom was already there.
The kingdom was there, yeah.
So, you know, some people differ with me on that, but I contend that it's always been, and that it just hasn't, you know, at different times it's been manifested. And but we understand the nature of the kingdom. And some people say, well, because the kingdom and the church are the same thing, that the church started on the day of Pentecost, therefore the establishment of the kingdom was on the day of Pentecost. Well, okay, I understand what you're saying, but we are talking about when, you know, the terms that Jesus says, "I will build my church." If the church and the kingdom are the same thing, then I agree that they are, because it's God's people. All right, I will build my called out. I will build my kingdom in the sense of the people. All right, the government had always been in the mind of God. Now it's coming to fruition. It's coming to where people understand that Jesus Christ is the head honcho. He is the king. Now you think about this. The kingdom that Jesus Christ is over is not the same kingdom of David. It's not the same. It's not the same people, because it's all the world. It's Jews and Gentiles.
Right.
And it's not the same law. It's a different law. Well, anyway, we get into things and we get into particulars, and we're not prepared to really flesh all that out in a program like this. I just simply wanted to say that this is not something that's premillennial in nature, and we have to mark it down by dates and time. You know, when Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world," he was saying it's not of earthly origin. It's spiritual in nature. It's in the mind of God. And he has to share that information, what it looks like, how it's made up, the organization, who's and think of this. Even in 1 Corinthians 15, Jesus will one day return the kingdom to his Father. You know, he'll hand it all back over, all rule and authority as king. He'll hand it back over to the Father. So there's been a shift in power for our sake. You know, Jesus has been appointed to be king. And how can Jesus, if the kingdom isn't already in existence, and I'm talking about premillennialism now, if it's not already in existence, then when he comes back and he hands it over to his Father, how is that even possible if it doesn't exist yet? You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
So you take something that's always been in the mind of God away from the premillennialists in this doctrine.
Right.
And Acts 2 does that, and 1 Corinthians 5 does that.
Mm-hmm. It's you get some of these weird ideas, and people have to manipulate Scripture to get what they want. And I'll be speaking in chapel at Brown Trail next week, and been asked to say, like, what have I learned since I got out of preaching school? And one of the things that I want to use is there's a picture of an axe with a wooden handle. Or with it, not a wooden handle, with a wooden head. And it says, just because you're unique doesn't mean you're useful. And we see so many brethren that at one time were sound get stuck on a hobby horse and get this weird idea that they think is going to make them unique. And they peddle that around the brotherhood. And what they end up doing is ostracizing themselves and leading themselves into damnation, because to keep that idea that they started off with, they have to manipulate so many scriptures to get there. And my advice is, say, preach the whole counsel of God.
Yeah.
Don't get caught up in a hobby.
All right. So, and I think we probably got caught up in a hobby just now, didn't we? But it is one of my
not
hobbies.
Not necessarily.
One of my hobbies is to refute false doctrine. But anyway.
Yeah.
Notice in verse number 6,
all right.
In that day declares the Lord, I will assemble the lame and gather the outcast, even those whom I have afflicted. And I will make the lame a remnant and the outcast a strong nation, and the Lord will reign over them in Mount Zion from now on and forever.
That sure sounds like a judgment day type passage. It could, but...
Well, it looks like the beginning of a reign, you know.
Yeah, that too. I mean, I can see, I mean, it's, you know, I'm not real good with the psalm type stuff and the poetry, but we can see here. I mean, I guess we can see at the beginning. I mean, we see that God is going to call his people one way or another.
Well, we are talking about Zion's future ruler.
Right.
I think we are looking forward to that new covenant. Remember.
Yeah.
God's initial promise was, I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel.
Yes,
remember?
Yes.
And so then the Gentiles, of course, are grafted into it. But anyway, I mean, we've got this coming king, this coming ruler. And look at verse number 9. Look at verse number 9.
Now, why do you cry aloud? Is there no king in you? Has your counselor perished? That pain seized you like a woman in labor? Writhe and groan, O daughter of Zion, like a woman in labor. Or now you shall go out from the city and dwell in the open country. You shall go to Babylon. There you shall be rescued. There the Lord will redeem you from the hand of your enemies.
I want to say this. The words daughter of Zion is Jerusalem.
Yeah.
It's the personified. It's being personified as a virgin.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And, you know, did you notice where it says the tower of the flock here? Did you read that?
Mm-mm.
Let's go down. Where did you stop?
I stopped at 10.
In verse 10. Okay, right. Writhe and labor to give birth, daughter of Zion, like a woman in childbirth. For now you will go out of the city, dwell in a field, and go to Babylon. There you will be rescued. There the Lord will redeem you from the hand of your enemies. And now many nations have been assembled against you. You who say, let her be polluted, let our eyes gloat over Zion. But they do not know the thoughts of the Lord, and they do not understand his purpose. For he has gathered them like sheaves to the threshing floor. Arise and thresh, daughter of Zion, for your horn I will make iron, and your hooves I will make bronze, that you may pulverize many peoples, that you may devote to the Lord the unjust gain, and their wealth to the Lord of all the earth. And so,
Now, I can understand somebody looking at that thinking it's going to be a physical kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, you have to look at all these context clues, and you have to look at what's being said to understand it's going to be spiritual. But if you see something like that, and you're a people that has been beaten down, you get to the first century, they're imprisoned, they're enslaved by Rome, and they're looking for a physical Messiah to get them out of it. And they look at passages like this and think, oh, we're going to get them, when it was spiritual.
Well, I see Babylon introduced here, and so I'm thinking about Babylon and captivity.
Yeah.
But, you know, when he says to arise and thresh, they should resist the assault with the assurance that Yahweh is fighting by their side. All right? Threshing is a process that separates grain from the chaff. So I think perhaps the idea here is that even in the effort to destroy Zion, some of the enemy would be converted by the power of the gospel. Now, again, I think there's dualistic concepts here. There's a physical restoration for the Jews, and then I think that we're talking about looking forward to the gospel age. But the rest of the enemies would be swept away as easily as chaff is blown from the threshing floor. So I think the question would be, you know, how can Zion thresh her enemies? And, you know, God would turn the threshing ox into a fighting bull is kind of the concept here. I will make your horn iron and your hooves brass. So the daughter of Zion has her mission to smash the pretensions of all those who plot the desecration of the city of God. Now, I look at this, and I can see the physical concept.
Right.
You know, I can see the hope. You know, this has got to, he's got to write. It's almost like Revelation, the book of Revelation. Those things were written to the churches, seven churches, of things which must shortly come to pass. Otherwise, those people would get no hope from that book.
Yeah, no hope.
And so, if that's something way off in the future, you know, then it doesn't mean anything. So this has to have a more temporal, executable application for the people who received this prophecy. Otherwise, why did Micah prophesy when he did? You know. Anyway, you look. We're looking forward a little bit more, and we see in chapter 5, beginning in verse number 1. Now muster yourselves in troops, daughter of troops. They have laid siege against us with a rod. They will smite the judge of Israel on the cheek.
The they, do you think that contextually is Babylon?
Yeah.
Or do you think that is a power?
Well, I don't necessarily know. You know, the daughter of Zion is urged to gather in troops. She is figuratively the daughter of troops. And the figure, I guess, means that the daughter of Zion is a lady under attack.
Mm-hmm.
Who's attacking her? Well, the term is used poetically for the Babylonian army.
Right, right.
If you look at Jeremiah 18:22. So, by Sennacherib.
Verse 2, but O Bethlehem, Ephrathah, who are too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to be ruler of Israel. And I have a reference here written in my Bible, Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 to 6. Micah chapter 5 and verse 2, this is the prophecy that lets us know that the Messiah was going to come from Bethlehem. And that, when I teach the adult class or teenagers, I say, you know, you look at the Messianic prophecy, and there's a lot of things people could do to try to match that. And we can decide a lot of things in our life, but one of the things we can't decide is where we're born.
Right.
So this prophecy was a miraculous, because, and it showed the power of God and the vision and the plan, because it excludes anybody born anywhere else.
Well,
as Messiah.
Here's the thing. I mean, if we are talking about 700 years difference,
mm-hmm.
that's more than several lifetimes for us.
Mm-hmm.
And for Micah to be preaching one thing and then jump 700 years into the future, I mean, of course, he doesn't know how, you know, when he's coming. they don't know when it's going to come to fruition. But just keep this in mind, that God's timetable is not ours.
No, no.
And so he can have – it's kind of like what Peter says about the second coming of the Lord. You know, there's going to be people who say, well, there's the promise of his coming. Everything's been the same since the beginning. Nothing ever changes. Where's the promise of his coming? And we have to be reminded that the coming of the Lord, you know, there is a day appointed at some point. We don't know when it is. And so we have to live in readiness. And I think that these people had to live in readiness. They had to live. I mean, if you look at Abraham, what I guess what I'm trying to say is that Abraham, if you look at Hebrews chapter 11, or Hebrews chapter, is that in that Hebrews chapter 11, the great faith chapter?
Yeah.
There are a couple of people in there that died never having received the promises in the flesh.
Abraham?
Abraham was one of them.
Yeah.
And so the promise was fulfilled. God kept his promise to him, but it was after he'd already gone to paradise.
Right.
And so that's kind of hard for us to get our mind wrapped around, that God can have that big a timetable and still keep his promise to us. How can I have hope in a leader that God's going to raise up 700 years from now? How does that give me hope? The government that oppresses me now will not even exist by the time that he gets here. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
So,
but they didn't know it was 700 years in the future. It could have been the next day. We have the benefit of hindsight.
The hope
is there that something was going to happen and that could help keep them going. And it did happen. It just wasn't in their lifetime.
Yeah. And I think that that's something we need to keep in mind.
It's like the return of Christ. We're prepared today. We're prepared tomorrow. We're prepared the next day. And the return of Christ may be in 2117. And we don't see it. But our hope is still there that there's going to be eternity and that Jesus is going to return.
Well, God is faithful who has promised.
Right.
And that's why Abraham was able to kill Isaac, because he knew that in his seed all nations of the earth would be blessed, and he knew that seed was Christ.
Oh, and he knew, I mean, you remember what he had said? He said, me and the boy will be back. And he goes up there knowing he was going to kill his son. So he knew that there was going to be something miraculous that could happen.
Well, yeah, and he didn't know that God was going to stay his hand.
Yeah.
He thought he would probably kill him and then he'd have to resurrect him to keep his promise.
Right.
But that was his, I mean, that was his thinking anyway.
His faith.
Yeah. So, but I just wanted to put that in there, because a lot of times we don't think in terms of the vast amount of time that's between all this. You know, there's lots of time. I mean, from the time even Abraham was promised that Isaac would be born, there's so many years that come in between there. And they had to learn that lesson, that God will do things on his own timetable. All you got to do is just sit back and enjoy the ride. Basically, is what we're called upon to do, right?
Stay faithful.
Stay faithful. All right, let's move on. What do we got next here?
Starting in verse 3, therefore he shall give them up until the time when she who is in labor has given birth, and the rest of his brothers shall return to the people of Israel. And he shall stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of his God, Lord his God. And they shall dwell secure, for he shall be great to the ends of the earth, and he shall be their peace. When the Assyrian comes into our land and treads in our palaces, then we will raise against him 7 shepherds and 8 princes of men, and they shall shepherd the land of Assyria with the sword, and the land of Nimrod at its entrances, and he shall deliver us from the Assyrian when he comes into our land and treads within our border.
So Micah is talking about Assyria now, which was the major power of his own day to symbolize all the hostile forces which would attack Messiah's kingdom. And so at times those enemy powers might even tread in our palaces, meet with some measure of success in their attack, I think. But against the enemy, God's people would set up 7 shepherds and 8 princes of men. Now, according to Smith, these spiritual leaders function as subordinates of the chief shepherd. In prophetic symbolism, 7 is the perfect number, the number which points to the completed work of God. The idea is that 7 would be enough to defend God's people. 8 would be more than enough.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that's interesting, because now we're getting kind of the numerology of prophecy.
Right. Where we have a problem with that, because, you know, we look at it and go 7, 8 and try to put numbers to it, and you find people doing all this number stuff where to them they would have understood this is complete and this is more than enough. So
he says the phrase princes of men means literally those anointed, appointed, or installed from among men. And so Messiah selects from among men those who will assist him in shepherding the flock and protecting it from its enemies. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Interesting.
Yep, that's what I thought. So we went into a prophecy about the coming of the Lord, and yet the context has remained in his day and time.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, you know, we haven't even popped out of his context. Now, mm-hmm. our brains thought in terms of the birth of Christ,
right,
700 years later, but He's not writing 700 years later. His brain is still speaking in terms of how, you know, Zion would experience ultimate victory. All right, what do we have next?
Starting in verse 7. Then the remnant of Jacob shall be in the midst of many peoples, like dew from the Lord, like showers on the grass, which delay not for a man, nor wait for the children of man. And the remnant of Jacob shall be among the nations in the midst of many peoples, like a lion among the beasts of the forest, like a young lion among the flocks of sheep, which, when it goes through, treads down and tears in pieces, and there is none to deliver. Your hands shall be lifted up over your adversaries, and your enemies shall be cut off. And in that day, declares the Lord, I will cut off your horses from among you, and will destroy your chariots, and I will cut off your cities of your land, and throw down all your strongholds. And I will cut off sorceries from your hand, and you shall have no more tellers of fortunes. And I will cut off your carved images and your pillars from among you, and you shall bow down no more to the work of your hands. And I will root out your Asherah images from among you, and destroy your cities. And in anger and wrath I will execute vengeance on the nations that did not obey.
Okay, well, there's several little things there that we could probably talk about in the last few minutes of our program this morning, and that is, let's talk about that refreshing dew from verse number 7. The remnant of Jacob will be among many peoples, like dew from the Lord, like showers on vegetation. Now, let's think about this for a moment. The message of salvation falls like dew or showers from heaven on barren hearts of the heathen. In these words, the promise to Abraham, bless them that bless you, is kind of projected into this generation. It's projected onto the age of Messiah, I guess you could say. Those who treat the spiritual descendants of Abraham sympathetically and listen to the word which they preach find refreshment. Now, it says that like the remnant of Jacob will be among many peoples, like dew from the Lord, like showers on vegetation, which do not wait for man or delay for the sons of men. And the remnant of Jacob will be among the nations like many peoples, or among many peoples, like, now here's another metaphor, like a lion among the beasts of the forest, like a lion among flocks of the sheep, which if he passes through, tramples down and tears, and there is none to rescue. So the remnant of Jacob is going to be like a lion. What do we know about lions?
Perhaps the Lion of Judah.
Yeah, well, you know, think of the King of the Forest. And, you know, like a lion. So it's a rending lion. The remnant may bring a refreshing message to the nations, but that remnant would be anything but feeble. And so you're looking at a picture of strength here. All right, so the empowerment of Zion. All right, that's what we're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
All right, then we have in verses 10 through 14, you notice the horses and the chariots. In verse number 10, the triumphs of Zion would not be accomplished by conventional instruments of war. If you look at verse number 10, he says, and it will be in that day, declares the Lord. Now, I've got those in quotes, that I will cut off your horses from among you and destroy your chariots. Now, God says, I'm going to cut off your horses and your chariots. Okay, I'm going to cut off the cities of your land. I'm going to tear down your fortifications. I will cut off sorceries from your hand. What's he telling you? You're not going to have fortune tellers anymore. What's he saying? He's talking about horses, chariots, cities, fortifications, sorceries, fortune tellers, carved images.
the gods that they formed with their own hands.
Everything they put trust in.
There it is.
Everything that they put trust in, God's going to take it out from among them. And he says, and I will execute vengeance in anger and wrath on the nations which have not obeyed. And so he's not just talking about, Jerusalem or Zion. He's talking about everybody. I think that's an interesting comment to make, mm-hmm. because it sounds like I'm going to take away your horses. But he may be talking about, he may be addressing this to the nations.
Yeah, I like what you'd said, because they were still under the law of the patriarchs. Is I'm going to take away everything that you've put before me, and you're going to be judged accordingly. And I think we can make that application today. You can even see it in congregations across the brotherhood. Is you've got brethren that can be on time for work, on time for sporting events, on time for competitions for their kids, on time for everything. But just can't do it on Sundays and have to stroll in about the time that communion starts and say, try doing that at work every day. What's your employer going to say? What about your kids' coaches when it comes to sports? If you show up 15 minutes into a game, but they can not only get there, but they can get there early. And we see right here there's so many things that people put before God. And he said, I'm going to take all those away. Those things are fleeting. Those things are going to get burned up. We need to make God number one.
Absolutely. Well, I tell you what, this has been an interesting week. The prophecy, Old Testament prophecy, it's not the easiest thing for me. I've got a lot of commentaries. I've got a lot of things I rely on. Okay, but one thing that was interesting that was said over in 1 Peter was that those Old Testament prophets were actually serving us. I believe Micah mm-hmm. served the people of today.
Oh, absolutely.
And he has spoken something concerning a man who would be a deliverer. All right, If Peter was right, I believe he was, Micah desired to look into who this was and when he was coming here in chapter 5.
Mm-hmm.
I think he wanted to know when this was going to happen too. Now, it's not revealed in this text that he thought those things, but Peter tells us that.
Yeah.
And, since we are talking about 700 years, I think it was something he desired to look into, you know.
Wanted to see it.
He wanted to see this come to fruition. And so there's the human element of wanting to see that, and I think about the resurrection day. I'd like to see it from this side of the ground.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, now, you know, if I'm in my grave and I'm going to get to experience resurrection, that would be pretty cool too.
Yeah.
But, I've always had it in my mind that I would just rather be on this side of the ground.
Well, that does it for our time today.
Man, we are so glad that you guys have joined us today.
And we're so thankful that Wednesday is your favorite day of the week. Tell your friends and family. But no, every week for Mornings for the Master is good. And every day. And we encourage you to tune in tomorrow. Tune in Friday as we continue on with our study. And for Chris Groda, I'm JJ. Have a great day. And remember,
we're proud of you.
Radio Network. Remember to join us each weekday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. Central Standard Time or catch the replay at 9 p.m. Central Time. You can also contact us at mornings@tgrn.org if you have any questions we can help you with, or if you have events you would like to submit to our bulletin board, or just with general feedback about the program or network. We would love to hear from you. As we've had opportunity to spend time with the Master this morning in His Word, let's remember His words in Luke 6:46, when He said, "Why call ye me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say?" He goes on to say in verse 47 and 48, "Whosoever cometh to me and heareth my sayings, and doeth them, I will show to you whom he is like. He is like a man which built an house, and digged deep, and laid the foundation on a rock. And when the flood arose, the stream beat vehemently upon that house, and could not shake it, for it was founded upon a rock. Let's show the wisdom of that builder, and go now to live for the Master.